Today's episode is sponsored by Audible, and today's novel, Flowers in the Attic by V.C. Andrews, is available through Audible.com's audio library, as well as many other titles by V.C. Andrews, and thousands of other titles by other authors. A Novel Podcast listeners can get a free trial and a free download of any audiobook by going to audibletrial.com/anovelpodcast.
You're listening to A Novel Podcast, in-depth discussions of literature from all genres and generations. I'm your host, Russell, and I'm joined today by my wife, Sarah, and our good friends, Sam, Jack, and Lauren. Today we're discussing Flowers in the Attic by V.C. Andrews. Written in 1979, it's the first book in the Dahlenganger series, told from the point of view of Kathy Dahlenganger. The book has seen much popularity, having been twice adapted into films, 1987 and 2014 respectively, and selling over 40 million copies worldwide. Fair warning, there will be spoilers in this podcast, so if you have not yet read the book, I would strongly recommend that you pause now and read it before you listen to this episode. In addition to that, if you're not familiar with the content of this book, there are some adult themes. Now, this book came to us as a strong suggestion from one of our regular co-hosts, so I'd like to ask Lauren to tell us what it is about this book that you enjoyed so much, why is it one of your favorites, and what did you hope that we would enjoy about it?
Okay, I actually don't remember initially.
That was me. I suggested that one.
Yeah, and then I kind of ran with it.
Yeah. We were all on board, though.
I got some agreements. I was excited.
Yeah, I was like, I hadn't read it in a really long time, and I'm like, I'm looking to revisit this because I need to like ease myself back into reading. I had attended the Red Hot Chili Peppers concert in May and met the guitarist Josh Klinghoffer, and I was having a really hard time concentrating and doing anything after that, so I was like slowly getting back into the writing and the reading, and I figured V.C. Andrews was very easy. But either way, it started very young. When I was little, my parents used to tape ALF for me, and I guess during the taping of ALF, we got a couple commercials for the Flowers in the Attic adaptation starring Christy Swanson in 87, and that frankly scared the bejesus out of like 4 or 5 year old me.
I don't remember that at all, seeing commercials, and I totally watched ALF.
Oh my god, it was like grandma's
You're so lucky that you remember it. It was just awful.
Yeah, it was like the commercials are scary, like the grandma's real mean, and like they were all trapped somewhere.
The creepy angles and the black and white creepy stuff that they like.
I should have probably watched a trailer.
Yeah, even the commercials for that version, even though it was terrible, you know, adaptation.
The commercials.
Creepy, yeah.
Yeah.
So, but like everyone read this in middle school, right?
I actually got into it later. Like I had, I remember people in sixth grade reading it, and I remember being salty because I wasn't allowed to read that or Stephen King. And then the next year, my mom let me read Stephen King, so I kind of forgot about V.C. Andrews. And then I ended up discovering V.C. Andrews when I was in 11th grade. We had to do a book report, and it had to be on an author who had our initials. Nobody had the initials L.V., like, at all. It was impossible. So I kind of hacked it. And my middle initial's A, so I'm like, well, V.C. Andrews, I'm like, there's a V and there's an A, and that's my middle and last initial. Can I just do that? And I think my teacher was just really sick of my mouth and was just like, yeah, you know, get a book and shut up. So I had ended up picking the first book in the Logan series, which was one written after her death that the ghostwriter had written. Yeah. Melody, yeah.
And Peterman, yeah, the Melody series.
So, like, I had read the Melody series, and, like, it was just so deliciously trashy that I'm like, okay, I need to read some original V.C. Andrews. So, I had grabbed Flowers in the Attic because it was a reissue copy back when I was in high school. Like, I'm holding my reissue copy right now. Like, when they released the Hudson series, I think they re-released a lot of the older books. And from there, like, I liked Flowers in the Attic so much that I'm like, I just have to kind of read all the V.C. Andrews. So I remember reading the rest of the Dahlenganger series, got into the Castile series, and then, you know, again, kind of forgot about it until the movie came out in 2014, ended up watching that and Petals on the Wind, forgot about it again, and then for some reason I had to look something up, I don't remember, and then I remembered that those movies existed, and it turned out that they had sequels for Seeds of Yesterday, which is the fourth book in the series, and If There Be Thorns, which was the third book in the series. So I watched Seeds of Yesterday because I was kind of curious to see how they were going to take that on. And it was just, again, just so like deliciously campy that I was like, I have to revisit this.
Okay, so with that being said then, Samantha, you said you enjoyed them as well. Did you discover them originally in middle school?
No, actually. My mom is a huge reader, and Mama had stacks of V.C. Andrews just chilling all over the place, just everywhere. My mom had a lot of books all over the place, but these covers were so dramatic and so interesting that I don't remember the other books that my mom had, but I sure do remember those V.C. Andrews books.
The Shrivel Grandma on Petals in the Wind.
Yeah. And then she had this was my mom. She got them like way back in the day. So she had the keyhole ones where I would like open it up and I would just imagine what was going on with the crazy dramatic, you know, scenes inside. And then finally, I don't know what it was. One day I just went and picked it up, and I was probably in like 7th grade, 8th grade, something like that. And this time she didn't take it away, whereas before she had taken away all the other times.
She's like, "You're ready.
Graduate, daughter. Let's discuss V.C. Andrews, because I've got shelves of them." And then as a gift later on, she gave me her entire Flowers in the Attic, and she had all of them from when they were first.
Oh, like the original.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, yeah, so I have them. They've been read and reread, and I also have extra copies because I'm rough on my books sometimes. I toss them in my purse or whatever. So I have an extra copy in case I feel like rereading it and taking it around with me. Because I reread it every couple years or so. But yeah, it's something that it's always been around the dramatic little scenes and the covers and the back of the books just seemed so titillating. I just needed to know what was going on, but I didn't get to until I was a little bit older. And they're definitely fascinating series. I find a really marked difference between the original V.C. Andrews little sections that she wrote and then the Ghostwriter books. Because, you know, the Ghostwriter books, they're all equally trashy. But the ghost, like, they're all equally definitely trashy. But the Ghostwriter books have a little tinge that it's a little different than V.C. Andrews. V.C. Andrews seems a little darker and a little more dramatic than the Ghostwriter kind of took things later on.
Yeah, it seems like with the Ghostwriter, a lot of times it's like turning out okay. Like I remember the Melody series, like everything turned out, good. Melody and Carrie got married, and
Everything turns out okay with Niederman, the Ghostwriter. But Kathy's story, the whole Dahlengeger series, it never got better.
No. Okay, so that's my question. Like, what was the point of this? It's not like love won out.
Well, it's just a gothic horror story. It's just a horror story. It's not a love story. I don't know if y'all have seen the covers that they were advertising recently, but I got a set because it made me laugh so hard. It's like Chris and Kathy, and there's like gorgeous blonde teenagers, and it's like rosy filtered light and sunset in the background. And it's super romantic, and I'm like, that's a misleading cover.
That's the copy that is sitting on the table between us right now.
Totally misleading.
That's what our library had.
They had actually expanded it, and they put out, I think, like, might have been last year or the year before, Christopher's Diary. Like, they put out two of Christopher's Diaries, and then something with Corey. And I picked up Christopher's Diary from the library, and I didn't finish it. Like, it's sitting on the nightstand right now, but it's still, like, that kind of, you know, the blonde teenager with, like, the soft light and supposed to look very,
mostly
like,
good looks. Yeah, they have Christopher's Diary, and then the next one was called Secret Brother. So I read both of those because, you know, because you guys can tell I'm pretty obsessed. So I read both of those. They're definitely different novels than Flowers in the Attic. They don't seem like the same stories to me, but.
Okay, so Jack, did you read this when you were younger?
No, this was my first time reading it.
Oh, okay, this was your first go-round.
Yeah, so I think I might have missed out on the, you know, 12-year-old interested in knowing more about sex. And, you know, the trashiness of it. And I think as an adult.
Going in with an adult.
I think this was one of the first dirty books I read.
Yeah.
And then as an adult, I mean, it's dirty, but for totally different reasons.
Yeah, it's...
How do you mean? Expand on that.
Well, it's the one of the first books that I read that had, like, a sex scene in it that was relatively graphic.
Yeah.
And now, as an adult, like, it's fairly graphic, but I'm more repulsed by, like, the behavior of the adults in the book than the behavior of the children.
Yes. Yeah.
So I would say adults, it's a different flavor of dirty now.
Like, yes. I was actually thinking about that on my walk today, and I was kind of thinking, I'm like, you know, like, they really, like, the grandmother actually kind of pushed them into this. Like, that whole thing, thinking about it, it's like, it's her fault.
It's definitely a self-fulfilling prophecy. She made that happen through her actions and through her inaction to, you know, to try and give them their freedom and give them their space. Like, she definitely made what happened between Chris and Kathy. Like, she definitely pushed them into it. She planted the seed for the idea to begin with because she was so paranoid about
Chris and Corinne. And it's like, you know, it was revisiting the sins of the father on the heads of the children, and... You know, they went up there relatively innocent, and they had been, you know, it was kind of like they had been accused so many times. Like, it was sort of like, oh, well, you know what, let's give her something to be upset about. You know what I mean? Even though...
May have never even crossed their minds had she not harped on it and just obsessed over it so much. That may have never... I mean, obviously, it's fictional. We'll never know the difference either way, but... Yeah. That may have never, ever happened between the two of them if she wasn't so obsessed with making it happen between them, you know, preventing it from happening.
And I was actually thinking, too, like, I hadn't really picked up on it so much as a teenager because I guess, like, I guess my mind wasn't there. But, like, you know, Chris raped her, and she was okay with this, and she fell in love with him. I'm like, he raped you, huh? Yeah. He raped you.
Yeah. And if you are, you know, you said you're familiar with the rest of the story, they stayed back and forth forever and ever, like, until they were dead, they stayed together. They died together. Like, it's weird.
Quick question. Did you read the Cutler series, Sam?
Yeah, I've read all of E.C. Andrews' books, all the way up until, like, maybe the last 2 years of releases, with the exception of Christopher's story and The Secret Brother.
Did you notice that the wording that V.C. Andrews used in the scene where Chris rapes Kathy, it's the exact wording that they use in the scene where Philip rapes Dawn?
Yeah, it's almost like phrase by phrase where they took names out and maybe just shifted the phrases around a little bit. But pretty much exactly the same.
I want to hear what the soul male on the podcast has to say.
Yeah.
Russ, this was your first time reading the book too, right?
This was your Correct. First, right? Not your last, I'm sure. You're going to reread this, right?
Mm, certainly. There was something in there that held my attention. It wasn't difficult for me to get through. It did get pretty tiresome. I mean, you guys revel in the trashiness of it to a degree that I can't understand or comprehend at all.
Well,
it's the guilty. We're acknowledging how trashy it is, but we still love it anyway.
Yeah. Russ, I haven't had the chance to give my opinion of it yet. I think I'm more in line with you.
Okay. But no, it wasn't difficult to get through. My thing was, I didn't particularly enjoy the story. Any story like this where the drama all comes from a human of some kind tends to bore me. If there's not some menacing supernatural element, aliens or monsters, then I tend to not be very interested unless it's historical. The thing that caught me, though, is I feel like there's got to be some kind of allegory here. I almost felt like it was Animal Farm-ish in that it's trying to say something. And I was trying really to figure out what it was, and I couldn't quite do it. I Google searched it for a few minutes and couldn't find anything that smacked me in the head. It just makes me wonder... Is it a symbol of adolescence in general? Like, is the attic the safety?
Well,
If you know a little bit about the author,
she was in a hospital, Sam?
She had a very serious accident right as she was in her teenage years, like 14, 15, real young. She had a serious accident that crippled her, and her mother was extremely overprotective. I don't know if y'all noticed who she dedicated the book to.
I, upon finishing the book, decided that was the most messed up part.
Right? Yeah, she dedicated the book to
her. This book is dedicated to my mother.
I? Really?
Yep. Crazy. The story was inspired by a doctor that cared for her.
That's what I was actually about to say.
So, like, to me, when I read it, maybe because, you know, we read it when we were teens, it also looks like it's almost written from somebody who's stunted's point of view. I don't think, frankly, she had the emotional intelligence to have an allegory, to have this symbolize anything. She was just writing a fantastical romance novel based on
some smart.
Yeah, she, like, because she had, like, the doctor, like, his story had kind of inspired it. I think she just took what she knew about him and she sort of ran with it and kind of crafted it into her own thing. I think that it was just, like, you know, when you're a teenager, everything's just kind of overdrawn and dramatic and fantastical, and she just kind of did that.
You fantasize about romance and the big, great big things that can happen. And that's a lot of what Kathy and Chris did throughout the whole novel. Obviously the twins could be freaking furniture. You know, we don't know what they thought about. But Kathy and Chris, they fantasize about being a doctor and maybe a playboy with all this money for a little while. And then I'll go into medical school and I'll be fabulously, you know, scientific and intelligent. And Kathy had this dream of being a
famous dancer.
Yes. Like, it just all became this huge fantasizing about the future and being big giant stars, and in the meantime chasing a little bit of romance. And she threw in the whole feeling trapped, because I feel like if her behavior later kind of shows, she probably felt trapped during her teenage years too, because once she started getting a little bit of a following and got into adult years, just before she died, she started coming out and doing her thing and was going to parties, and she was disabled, so it was kind of a big deal for her to be out. She probably had a little bit of those trapped feelings when she was, you know, younger. I don't think it was a symbol for a whole lot. I think it was just
that. I think it's interesting that you point out that it was written from a bit of a stunted point of view. And when I reconsider it, thinking about that, it's slightly less hard to swallow. So here you have Chris and Kathy. And Chris is supposed to be brilliant.
Oh, yeah.
And Kathy's no slouch. She's okay. And at one point in time, they're locked in the attic for 3 weeks with no outside contact and no food. And at no point in time are they like, hey, why don't we just tie these sheets together and hop on out of here?
Yes, they were. Remember, they were going to.
They did.
Okay, so then eventually they tie the sheets together and they only go out like once.
I think a lot of it hinged on the twins because they were too weak. They couldn't.
They were looking at the twins as parents now.
I just feel like that's such a writing crutch. Like, okay, yeah, the twins can't go on the roof, or they don't want to go on the roof. But, like, Chris can go get some help and be like, hey, see the big spooky house on the hill? You know, the old lady has us prisoner up there. Hmm. Might be my mom. I don't know. Somebody. It's real messed up there, though, guys.
But they also harp on a lot of family ties, of how crippling family ties truly are. It wasn't that locked door and that being high in the attic that kept them in.
Stockholm syndrome at one point.
It was
because crippling. Christopher, like, he didn't really believe up until the very end, up until when they gave Mickey the donut. And, like, that's kind of when it clicked for him, like, prior to that. And then he also mentioned when he went down to steal money and he saw the grandfather's wheelchair and he heard the butler and the maid after they were done banging talking about how the old man was dead, and he realized that the grandfather had died. Like, it didn't really click for him. Like, he always kind of thought that his mother was going to be there. Like, his mother was his champion all the time, and he really his believed in her.
So let's talk about mom for a second here.
I think that.
So the first time I read this, I was, you know, 13, 14, middle school-y.
Yeah.
And I remember the grandmother just being really terrible and wow.
And the sad thing is, if you read Garden of Shadows, the grandmother actually wasn't as awful. Like, they make her out to be, like, really overblown and terrible in Flowers in the Attic. And then you read Garden of Shadows, which is from her point of view, and you're like, she really didn't treat her as monstrously as she told the kids that she treated her.
Well, yeah.
All right, now let me interrupt and ask two quick questions here about the grandmother. The first is, there's a moment very early on when they're making their paper garden in the attic.
Yeah.
That the grandmother brings them a gift of real flowers or something along those lines.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah, she brings them some mums.
Now, Now, why did she do that, and then a few months later, they make her a Christmas present, and she completely rejects it? But this is before that they had done anything to get out of line or on her bad side.
They're unholy. They're impure. They're disgusting. They cannot.
Then what was the point of the flowers, from either a practical or a literary standpoint?
I think it was a moment of weakness. Like, they were kind of just showing some chinks in her armor. Like,
she wasn't
trying
always
to show
a
that she was, like, hardening herself to the fact that she wasn't going to let these kids get to her, and they sort of did get to her a little bit, and then she had hardened herself at that point where she
went totally the opposite direction after that gift. It was like the door was closed, and there was never again an opportunity, a hope, a chance.
And
you
it was
know,
also was the it. Thing of, she had told them, and I don't know if you remember this, Sam, she said that they should never do anything to win her favor. So she had given them
never love anything that's unholy or impure in the eyes of God.
And that was like for her, like that was like out of her own accord. But then giving the Christmas present, maybe in her eyes, was them trying to win her over. And like she said that she couldn't love anything that was impure. Yeah. So it might have also been the
that
fact that they were trying to win her favor.
Does it make sense?
Yeah.
Looks like there's something there.
There's something there.
So the second question is, from the reader in the children's perspective, we're led to believe that it is the evil, vindictive grandfather who is ruining everything, and as soon as he's gone, everything will be fine. Now, was that true? And, see, there was a moment when they go out, and they're hiding in that cabinet during the party, and they look and they see the grandfather, and he appears, from that perspective, to be kindly. Was it the grandfather just not know anything, and it was only the mother and the grandmother who were trying to get rid of the kids?
Nah, man, I bet he'd have hooked him up with some Werther's if they had met him.
He had put a stipulation in his will that said if it was ever proven that Corinne had children by Christopher, that she would be disinherited.
Uh-huh.
Because that was the whole thing in Petals on the Wind with Bart Winslow when Kathy seduces him. At the end, he says, you know, she said, I did this because my father would have ripped me out of the will. I wouldn't have had anything. You wouldn't have wanted me. And Bart said, we would have found a way to get around that. You can't justify murdering your children.
Yeah, I mean, I think, I know that that's out there. I know that's what she said happened. And I know, like, that's what was going on. But I really don't think the grandfather did that. I honestly think it was the grandmother that was behind that, just to get Corinne one final time. I feel like the grandfather was old and he was infirm, and at one point he really did love Corinne dearly, and he even sent private detectives after her, and the grandmother intercepts the letter, and the grandmother's the only one who knows about the kids. I mean, I'm sorry, that's in a different book. I'm sorry. But later on, that's what happens. Like, they send a pair of private detectives, and the private detectives do track down Corinne and Christopher, and they do know about the birth of all four of the kids. They get announcements from it, but the grandmother intercepts them, and the grandfather never knows that the kids exist. It's never out there. So later on, when they come back and the kids are there and they're in the attic, I don't think that. Just knowing a little bit about the story, I don't think that the grandfather did really write that. I truly think that the story kind of points at Olivia, the grandmother, having written that as a codicil in the will.
So let's circle back to Corinne.
The mother.
Who's the worst?
The worst ever.
She's horrible.
And she's awful because she's got a pretty face and a good, like, a seductive, happy charm to her. She's awful because she's beautiful and charming and is just a cruel, horrible person inside. Like, there's,
and the thing was, too, like, she acted as if she couldn't do anything. She acted very stupid. She was very cunning. Like, it was almost like beauty, no brains, but there was a brain in there, and it just kind of knew how to manipulate and how to push and how to get people to do what she wanted. Like, their house was kind of testament to that, because if you remember at the beginning, everything was repossessed, and, you know, all of those fancy things had been bought by Christopher for Corinne so she could keep up appearances.
Yeah. She was very little to no substance. She just knew how to use her looks to get ahead and didn't seem to have a very She didn't have a conscience about who got hurt along the way.
Well, obviously.
Isn't there a bit of a scene in the Song of Ice and Fire where Cersei is teaching Sansa how she can use her powers to manipulate in that same way?
I think so.
Is there a parallel you can draw between Cersei and Corinne?
No. Cersei loved her children.
Perhaps she loved them too much.
Well, that was not the problem here.
With Cersei loved Joffrey and Marcella and Tommen despite any flaws that they had, and she didn't want them to die. So, like, it ended up almost like they were collateral damage. Like, the only one that I kind of felt like she was somewhat responsible for was Tommen, because she had to know that, you know, killing Margaery was going to, you know, make Tommen go over the edge. But
literally,
it wasn't intentional. Whereas Corinne, it was very calculated. It was very intentional. She meant to do that to her children. Like, her children were a means to an end. Whereas I didn't feel like Cersei's children were a means to an end. Like, she truly did love them.
Okay, so with Corinne, the letters that she's writing, and she finally says, oh, we found a place where we can stay. Everything's going to be fine. Whose idea was it to imprison and poison the children? Was it Corinne? Was it the mother? Grandmother?
I think
the mother's idea to imprison them. Yeah, the grandmother's idea to imprison them, but it was Corinne's idea when she knew they could never get out. It was Corinne's idea to poison them.
Because if you remember, the grandmother had always warned them against eating sweets. She told them that it was because they couldn't go to a dentist, but it turned out that they were eating those powdered sugar donuts, like, very eagerly, when all the while she had warned them, you know, don't eat sweets.
Don't eat the sweets. And also, remember at the beginning, right before they went into the attic, when Corinne was reading the letters that she got from her mother, Kathy described her as staring at them for a hard minute, staring at them hardly and crying. And she was saying, why was she crying so much? She was crying. I think they definitely hatched the plan to lock the kids up long before, you know, forever, basically, long before they got there. And I don't think that was Corinne's plan. I think she went along with it, you know, out of greed and avarice, but I don't think she intentionally, you know, had the idea of we're going to lock them up when she initially wrote them or anything like that. I think that's all ground.
No, I don't know. If you're coming from an abusive household, you go get a job at McDonald's or whatever the equivalent was.
She didn't, though. She didn't come from an abusive household. She had a great upbringing. She went to private school. She was never abused. She lied to those kids.
Yeah. If you
her story later,
Garden of Shadows, she was doted upon. She was spoiled.
She was spoiled and rotten. Like
she had told a story to Kathy about the first time that she had her menstrual period. And that turned out that wasn't even true. And Garden of Shadows, she went and told her mother. It wasn't that she was riding bikes and discovered it and had to change panties several times because she didn't know what was going on. She went to her mother. She, like, knew, and her mother was, like, oh, okay, and, you know, supportive of her.
I mean, I didn't read the rest of the series, but I don't know. I feel like if you are that sadistic as a grandmother, you certainly have a pattern, a history of abuse
right.
without their children. Yeah. It was the whole thing out of religious, religion. I think, like,
yeah, that was out of religion.
Religion corrupts.
Definitely.
Because in Garden of Shadows, they reference her finding religion, and their butler was her cousin or something, and they talk about them going to the chapel and praying, and she, as Malcolm kind of womanizes and does his thing, she gets more into prayer. And then after her two sons die, she, like, kind of goes off.
She goes into despair. Yeah, she goes into despair, and she uses religion to distract her from how she's falling apart. It's definitely out of religious. It wasn't out of abuse, because Corinne had a very good upbringing. That was all out of religious fervor on between John Amos, the butler, and the grandmother.
Olivia
Foxworth. Which is weird, because an author reuses that later on in, what was it, the Logan series?
It was the grandmother was Olivia.
Yeah. Yeah. Crazy grandma Olivia out there.
I don't know.
Okay, so it it seems like we're pretty split right down the middle here. So, Jack, I don't think we've gotten your full opinion on this yet. Did you find...
I don't know if you want
my I do. I do. But I want to know, did you find... Any any merit in this book whatsoever? Was there something you enjoy? Was it easy for you to get through? What was your opinion?
All right. So just to preface this, I am not against, you know, I read books of all different kinds. My negativity is not coming from the incest or the sadistic nature and the torture of the children and the eventual murder of a child. I did not like this book because it was so horribly written. And I felt it was almost like V.C. Andrews was a pervert and this was her writing out some sort of sexual fantasy.
Right?
Yeah.
And she's not really an author. It's just her fantasy. That's how I felt.
Like, she made up a scenario, and then she was like, okay, how can we get there from here?
Yeah.
How can I get to the point where it's okay for these two to do their thing in the attic?
And one of the things, and you're absolutely right, it is awful writing. One of the things that I frequently, like, do a mental eye roll, and I'm like, nobody freaking talks like that. Like,
No. It was almost kind of just imitating what she thought, like, a gothic.
Okay, and then, like, allegedly, Grandma Olivia is so worried about the maids finding them, but she somehow gets a bucket of hot tar.
Yeah.
Because that's a thing that you can just get.
Yeah. And a hypodermic needle with something that keeps people asleep.
Right, that's just something you can pick up.
The hypodermic needle probably came from Malcolm. Like, she could have easily explained the needle, not the
tar. But a bucket of hot tar, right. That's not something that you just have, even if you live in a mansion with a ballroom and whatnot. And then pours it all over Kathy's head, and, like, the maids aren't going to notice that?
I think they were paid well enough not to notice that.
And I don't think there were very many servants. I think that the servants did come in at a certain time.
I don't know.
But I don't think there were very many.
I know it was done in, like, the dead of night, so I don't think there would have been.
I'm with you here, Jack, though. Like, I think she I think she wanted to get to these scenarios. Like, and how can I get there from here?
Okay, so to the detractors to this novel, let me ask you this. Is there another piece of literature that you think this demographic would enjoy equally, but that you think does have some kind of merit? Something else that the tween teen, someone looking for a forbidden romance might enjoy?
Well, I think that's what kind of speaks to why this book is so popular, because no. I mean, that's why this book has been translated into so many languages, and it has, you know, endured the test of time. As silly as the writing is, and as terrible as the subject matter is, you know, there's other books that explore different themes throughout the book, like romance and being locked up and incest, but there's not a book that really discusses them or intertwines all these taboos the same way. Mothers killing their children, that's already dramatic enough as it is, much less all this extra thrown in there. I think,
you know, on top of it, watch what else they do.
But wait, there's more.
Yeah, like, mama killed her kids, there's a religious taboo, there's a incest, there's a dying child, there's, like, so many things going on with this. It's so dramatic and so over the top that I think it's its own genre. It kind of started the...
It is sort of, I would, it is sort of its own thing.
Yeah, there's a, you know, 20 novels, 30 novels after... Yeah. Flowers in the Attic in the V.C. Andrews franchise, that I think it's become to the point where it's becoming its own genre, you know?
Yeah. Yep. I don't know. But yeah, I think it's kind of its own thing. I haven't read a ton of young adult. This is one of the dirtiest ones I've read, I think.
Yeah, I think kids these days are just better on the internet.
Well.
All those sites, they shouldn't be.
Don't read this. Right? Don't read Flowers in the Internet, in the Attic. Go on the internet. Yeah. Like, don't.
Or you're looking at your brother that way.
Here are the good porno sites. Have fun. Read Flowers in the Attic in the library.
If you look at anything but this, please.
And then, you know, they even bring that up in the novel when Chris and Kathy find the pornographic material in Mom's room.
Oh, yeah.
They found, like, a sex book in the room.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. How to do designs in needlepoint.
Yep. That's what the
I totally want to start using that as code now too.
I actually, what I would like to do, I don't know if y'all have seen where they have, like, the memes with crazy book covers and people just go read them on the train. I would like to get a how to do designs in needlepoint one and see who catches it. Just kind of see.
Do it and then let us know.
Trash book if you recognize this title.
I was reading this and I started a job where I have a commute on public transportation, and I didn't even want to pull this out because I was like, I don't want anyone to see what I'm reading. I am a grown adult right now. And I do have the like hot pink lovey romance cover. I was like, I'm on my way to a major city in a business suit. Like, I can't bust out VC Andrews right now. I mean, I can.
I'm adulting right now. I can't be reading VC.
Right.
I am adulting all the way.
I have no shame. I'll read it.
Maybe if I had a nice how to do designs in needlepoint cover, maybe I really do need to look into that.
Problem solved. You could probably print one up on the internet and just cut it, you know, print a little template up.
If I just cut and pasted, like I would have to make sure the printer was out of magenta or something too, so it was just extra terrible looking.
I would need pictures and the template
I will see what I can do. I like it.
I haven't heard anybody say a thing about the father. What's his deal?
He's furniture like Corian and Carrie are. He's furniture too, yeah. And they don't really expand.
She was like, hey, I need a bronzed Adonis, and I'm going to kill him on his birthday. That's how we're going to get there from here.
Mm. Yeah.
Even in Garden of Shadows, he was just
kind of.
Yeah, like, he didn't really have much of a personality. You know, he just, like, Olivia loved him because he was, like, a nice kid, mm-hmm. but we don't really see him progress beyond just being a nice kid.
Like, yeah, he's like, oh, I get good grades in school. I don't ask questions. I avert my eyes, you know, say my prayers. He's really bland. He doesn't have
a Ken doll.
He's a Ken doll, yeah.
Ken doll, yeah, yeah, exactly.
And even, like, in the beginning, they're like, oh, well, daddy travels for work and he makes great money, but they're never like, he's a banker.
He's a PR agent.
Advertising or PR or something.
But it was all very generic.
You know, he's so gorgeous that nobody could resist him. So he's an agent for an ad agency.
Totally plausible.
And I think she just didn't get into like a lot of detail on that because if she wrote it when she was younger, more than likely she didn't have the tools to research it.
She didn't write it when she was younger. She was 56. That's not young.
Really? Yes. No.
Yeah, I don't think she was young when she wrote it, but I think, like I said, she was stunned when she did.
I can definitely accept that point of view.
There's a rest of development there. Yeah.
She didn't really come out into society, even though she had lots of books into print. She didn't really come out into society until she was older because, you know, her mom was really overprotective, like I mentioned earlier. So I don't think she was very good at socializing.
So I thought it was kind of sad because she was 50.
Mentally 50.
Yeah, maybe. She was 56 when she wrote this, and then she had some great success, and now you're saying she came out into society. And then she died when she was only 63 of breast cancer. So she only had, like, 7 years of living.
Yeah, she died. Yeah, she was only out in society for a year.
Imagine the kind of stuff she could have come up with if she had spent more time with people. If this is what she came up with on her own.
I don't know if she would have come up with that stuff, because, like, I feel like it was just, again, it was more of like a fantastical thing. Like, you know, she took, again, this doctor story that she was inspired by and all these things that she thought, like, people did. I think if she was out in the world, I don't think we would have it, to be totally honest.
Got a bit like asking James Hetfield to write a song while he's not drunk.
Yeah.
I'm with Jack a little bit. No, I'm with Jack. But I think I didn't dislike it quite as much as you did, Jack, because I think I had that background of reading it when I was younger. When you're younger, you're not expecting as much. So there was a little bit of nostalgia for me.
Hmm.
But holy cats, I did not hate the mother nearly as much when I was 15.
Rose-tinted glasses. Okay. Well, let's go ahead and round robin with everybody. Tell me a little bit about what else you've been reading, what you would like us to do next, if you're reading 1Q84 and plan to record that with us for our next episode. Let's go ahead and start with Sam.
Well, actually, I just checked out 1Q84 from the library, so hopefully that comes in pretty soon. I put it on hold, so they should call me up and let me know it's ready, and I will be ready to record with you, because that looks like a really good story.
Do you read quickly?
Yes, I do. I read very, very quickly.
Good, because that's a long book, and we need to record that episode soon.
Don't worry. I'll get through it. I read very, very quickly. I think I read it in, like, 2 days, so...
Oh, that's impressive.
Like, it was maybe, I mean... I used to work 2 days a week. So I started it Friday night and finished it like Sunday night, Monday morning at like 2, 3 in the morning. So I mean, you know, I read it through that span of time. So I'm probably pretty sure I can get through it quickly.
And we're going to record an episode on it the month after IQ84. Is that correct?
Yes.
I'm down for that.
I'm down for that too. I love it like I love Flowers in the Attic. So it's
It, for many years, was my favorite book of all time.
It's a good one.
It will be much more my speed.
Yeah, I just took my husband to see the new one, and he's never seen the original, never read the book, so I was, like, filling him in on the story, and he was all over it. So our family is going to do a screening of the original one just before Halloween.
Ah, so that's a funny plan.
Pennywise is my desk buddy at work.
Nice.
That's cool.
I see. This is the murdering of children I can get behind.
Yeah, me too.
don't make it some creepy mom. Make it some creepy clown, please.
It's night and day.
It is. It's a big difference. I'm not a creepy clown. I am a mom who, you know, tries to not be creepy, but
yeah.
All right. So sorry for derailing you there, Sam. Please continue.
No worries. Other than that, not a whole lot. I've been working on trying to gather a few pictures together. In the last year, I've done a lot of traveling, and the end of last month, I went to Las Vegas, and I realized, looking through my pictures, I've got a ton of them, so I want to put, like, a travel, you know, Instagram or a travel blog together, just going through some of the stuff that that I've been doing over the past year. I went into Las Vegas at the beginning of September, end of August, and me and my now husband, he was then my fiancé, ran away and got married.
Oh, good for you. Congratulations.
Thank you. So since we got a ton of pictures and really cool stuff to look at, and I have a bunch of stuff from when I was in Europe earlier this year, I wanted to work on doing a little project like that to get rid of some of my creative juice that I got flowing.
All right. And Lauren, how about yourself?
All right. I am, since I'm back at school, I'm rereading The Crucible because that's what the kids are reading right now. So kind of excited for that because I really like The Crucible. And It's like good to get into for like Halloween. Trying to get back into reading, but like, you know, trying to also find the time with like my schedule, because this is the first year I've actually had to travel. Like, I go from the high school to the middle school to teach a section of Honors 8. So this is the first time I've actually had to like travel between schools, and I'm trying to like kind of get used to that. So any reading on my part's either been reading for score or rereading. Trying to get back into writing too. For a while, like, I had a lot of free time last year when I was day-to-day subbing, so I was on a roll with writing. Like, I was just kind of churning them out like constantly, and then like I sort of slowed down a bit on it. Not too much. Like, I met Josh Klinghoffer. I ended up meeting Herschel. Like, we went to a horror con over the summer, and I met Herschel from The Walking Dead.
That's really neat.
He was sick. So, like, we all got, like, kind of, like, allergy, like, issues a week after that. We were all blaming Herschel for getting us sick.
Meeting somebody from The Walking Dead and having them be sick, that's kind of scary.
It was definitely the word.
Yeah, he had, like, he had his little tissues on him and stuff. And, like, my husband was scratchy throat the next week. And I'm like, ooh, Herschel got you sick. And we met Tom Savini.
Definitely going to be a zombie.
And we met Tom Savini. Well, that's okay, because I actually learned how to shoot crossbow back in April. So if he's a zombie, I can take care of that.
All right.
Nice.
And I want you on my zombie apocalypse survival team.
Awesome. I will be there. But I'm just really trying to get back into the writing now, because like I said, I was churning them out. I have a bunch of ideas. It's just trying to like get them written in.
And Sarah, how about yourself?
I have been reading Bear Town by Fred.
Yes. I didn't know you were reading that.
You did. You commented on my Goodreads, which I love.
Okay, I knew you were reading that then. I'm still excited.
Well, no, I've been dragging my feet. I've been reading it for like 2 weeks, which is way too long for that book. Oh, but I also read In the Garden of Beasts by Eric Larson, who did The Devil in the White City. So that one was the American diplomat in Hitler's Berlin. And it was a good read. I do like Eric Larson. And then Beartown is pretty good. I just got to the good part. So I'm plowing through with that. And I thought we were going to read The Martian next.
I know. I think The Martian's going to be a minute.
Okay.
We'll discuss. 1Q84 is next. And then after that, we'll figure it out. It's The Martian, 1Q84, It, and then the next episode I talk about in a second.
Oh. Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Okay. And Jack,
yeah.
Jack, how about yourself?
I am reading, so I think we've talked before. Oh, well, the first episode was a Stephanie Plum novel.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I am reading Jana Ivanovich's other series, the Fox and O'Hare series.
Is it any good?
Oh, what a clever pun.
I didn't even notice that. You're right. From this podcast. I just finished the second book today. I was just telling Sarah this too. It's not as good as the first 10 or so Stephanie Plum novels, but it's better than the last 10 or so Stephanie Plum novels.
Which is such a good assessment of Stephanie Plum novels. The first 10. And then the last ones were the thing.
That sucks because that 10th one was like awesome. Like
that 10th one's my favorite.
Yeah. Sally Sweet and the School Bus is like amazing.
I'm totally up for it. I wouldn't mind maybe doing a true crime because I've, as much as I like murder and mayhem, I don't think I've ever finished a true crime novel.
Helter Skelter. Or like since Anne Rule died, we should do like some Anne Rule Stranger Beside Me.
I could get behind Anne Rule.
I had an Anne Rule from the library, and I just had too much on my plate. I didn't even crack it before it had to go back. So I would be in for that.
The Stranger Beside Me is awesome. Like she like was friends with Ted Bundy, so it's kind of like neat to see her side of it because she didn't really see any of it coming. Like they were friends.
Spoiler alert.
I think that's doesn't common knowledge. At the end. I think that's common knowledge, Sarah.
Oh, fair enough. And the book's like 20 years old, too,
she,
right?
That so. She worked with him.
30 or 40 years old, I think. She wrote in like the 70s, I think.
Hmm.
1980.
Yeah. Green River Running Red was pretty good, too. That was like her account of the Green River murders.
That was the one I had here.
That was awesome. You should like read that.
I know. I was reading a bunch of other stuff. All right.
Okay, so I'm currently reading 1Q84, about halfway through. Would never have made it on paper, so I'm glad I'm listening to it on audiobook. Then after that, we're going to be doing The Martian and It, although not necessarily in that order. But here's the big news. We have applied to do a live broadcast from the Gaylord National Harbor just outside of Washington, D.C. for MAGFest. That's the first weekend in January. So we're going to be reading for that episode Ready Player One. And so if any of our listeners are in the area, want to stop by and watch us do that episode, we'd love to see you there. And if any of our common co-hosts are going to be in the area and want to join us, we'd love to have you with us for that episode as well. Still setting up the details. Now, we have not yet gotten approval for the panel to actually go forth. We probably won't have that until December. But if any of you guys could go to magfest.com or magfest.org, I'm not sure which it is, shoot them an email saying that you want to see a novel podcast at this year's MAGFest. I would appreciate it because I think that could be a big boost for listenership as well. And I'm looking forward to that book. Now, that will get us through January. After that, I'm open for anything true crime or more horror, sci-fi, whatever our usual suspects are.
We keep talking about a Victorian one.
Well, you pick it. I'll read it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Outside of that, I've been I caught up on a Game of Thrones and I am catching up on The Walking Dead. And then that's about it.
Oh, I'm going to be Negan for Halloween.
Ah.
Because I found a really cool leather jacket at Marshall's, and I was like, or I think it's fake leather. And I was sweet. Like, this would be a perfect Negan jacket. So yeah. I got it, and now I'm going to be Negan.
That's cool. So I remember seeing all the memes when he was first introduced, and everyone said the one I remember seeing was, it was a picture of Joffrey and a picture of Ramsay Bolton, and then a picture of Negan, and it said, "I'll never hate anyone as much as I hate I'll never hate anyone as much as I hate Ram." Oh, now we go.
See, I like Negan. Like,
I think he's fantastic.
I love Negan. Like, Negan's my boy.
A little bit of a psychotic. Y'all are talking about
a little bit of a psychotic, though, but just such a delightful psychotic.
And like, he has his own kind of twisted moral code, and I really like that. Like,
Well, you see that as
above, like, bashing somebody's skull in, but you can't hurt women. That's not okay. It's not cool, dude.
And you you kind of see that moral code kind of ripple through the show. I mean, obviously the protagonists have always had their moral code, but then you remember that group that Daryl was with for a little while? You know, what was their thing? Claim it, call it, something like that?
Something. It was, yeah, it was that guy that looked like Ron Perlman.
They had their own little rules. Yeah. And then there was the rules behind the group that was taken over by cannibals. They had rules.
Terminus, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway. Anyway. That's what I've been doing.
That is what you've been doing.
All right, any final comments before we call it a night?
Did you buy powdered sugar donuts for the kids? You know what? Your mom buys our kids powdered sugar donuts all the time.
Mm-hmm. But not every day.
I don't know. It probably is every day.
I made sure to stock up. As soon as I found out I was expecting, I was like, let's roll.
Oh, congratulations.
No, I'm just kidding. I'm totally kidding.
On arsenic?
On which part, yeah.
Or donuts?
On all of it.
The entire thing.
On all of it. Mine is already going on 3 years old. I don't know. I don't know about anything else.
You know what?
I
didn't watch. I actually haven't seen either adaptation of
God, there's a part, you know, in Petals on the Wind when Carrie eats the donuts at the end to kill herself.
Yeah.
I distinctly remember Henny telling Kathy, oh yeah, she was cooking, and there's like all these ingredients for donuts on the counter, and then there's a big thing of rat poison, and it's like, didn't that set something off in your head that she had rat poison right by the food? Like, didn't that, like, well, I don't know, get the wheels turning?
I mean, you don't want the rats in your food.
Like,
right?
Come on that now.
That just reminds me of that Far Side comic where the two rats are cooking and the one says, I don't even know why we have this, but do we have to keep it next to the cereal?
Oh, Gary Larson.
And on that note, I think we'll close it up. Thanks everyone for joining us.
All right.
Thank you. It's a good time, guys. Take care.
Thanks. Peace out.
Bye.
Bye.
A Novel Podcast is looking to produce more episodes, and we want you to join us. If you like reading novels and then talking about them, then you're a perfect candidate. We record remotely, so your location on Earth isn't a consideration, and no prior experience is necessary. Send us an email or a tweet, and let us know what books you'd like to discuss. A Novel Podcast at gmail.com or at A Novel Podcast. Look forward to hearing from you.